Hello, everyone. We are continuing on with John Owen's treatise on mortification of sin in believers. And last time we did chapter 3, and I will go over the main points. He talks about the second general principle of the means of mortification proposed to confirmation. The Spirit, the Holy Spirit, is the only author of this work. Vanity of popish mortification discovered. Many means of it used by them not appointed of God, those appointed by him are abused, the mistakes of others in this business, the Spirit, Holy Spirit, is promised believers for this work, all that we receive from Christ is by the Spirit, how the Spirit mortifies sin, the several ways of his operations to this end or purpose proposed, and how his work is in our duty. Are a part of that. And that brought us up to chapter 4, which, Lord willing, we're going to continue on with for this reading. Now, I'll go ahead and begin. Again, chapter 4, and I'll go through the summary points at the beginning. He says it's the last principle of the usefulness of mortification. The vigor and comfort of our spiritual lives depends on our mortification. In what sense? Not absolutely and necessarily, Psalm 88, Heman's condition, not as on the next and immediate cause, as a means by removing of the contrary, the desperate effects of any unmortified lust, and lust is, again, just generally any corrupt desire of the heart. So, again, the desperate effects of any unmortified lust. It weakens the soul, Psalm 38, verses 3 and 8, in sundry ways, and it darkens it. All grace is improved by the mortification of sin, and finally, the best evidence of sincerity. Now, Mr. Owen says, the last principle I shall insist on, omitting first the necessity of mortification unto life, and secondly, the certainty of life upon mortification is, and so overall, Roman numeral 3, that the life, vigor, and comfort of our spiritual life depends much on our mortification of sin. He says, strength and comfort and power and peace in our walking with God are the things of our desires. Were any of us asked seriously what it is that troubles us, We must refer it to one of these heads. Either we want or lack strength or power, vigor and life in our obedience, in our walking with God, or we want or lack peace and comfort and consolation therein. Whatever it is that may befall a believer that does not belong to one of these two heads does not deserve to be mentioned in the days of our complaints. Now, all these do much depend on a constant course of mortification, concerning which, observe. Point number one, I do not say they proceed from it as though they were necessarily tied to it. A man may be carried on in a constant course of mortification all his days, and yet perhaps never enjoy a good day of peace and consolation. So it was with Heman in Psalm 88. His life was a life of perpetual mortification and walking with God, yet terrors and wounds were his portion all his days. But God singled out Heman, a choice friend, to make him an example to them that afterwards should be in distress. Can you complain of it being no otherwise with you than it was with Heman, that eminent servant of God? And this shall be his praise to the end of the world. God makes it his prerogative to speak peace and consolation. Isaiah 57, verses 18 and 19. I will do that work, God says. I will comfort him, verse 18. But how? By an immediate means no means, an immediate work of the new creation. I create it, God says. The use of means for the obtaining of peace is ours. The bestowing of it is God's prerogative. Point number two, in the ways instituted by God for to give us life, vigor, courage, and consolation. Mortification is not one of the immediate causes of it. And again, immediate is there's nothing in between. So it does not of itself directly cause it. They are the privileges of our adoption made known to our souls that give us immediately these things. The Spirit bearing witness with our spirits that we are the children of God, giving us a new name and a white stone adoption and justification, that is, as to the sense and knowledge of them, are the immediate causes in the hand of the Spirit of these things. But this I say, point number three, in our ordinary walking with God and in our ordinary course of His dealing with us, the vigor and comfort of our spiritual lives depend much on our mortification, not only as a, in his Latin words, causa sine qua non, but as a thing that has an effectual influence thereinto. For, subpoint one, this alone keeps sin from depriving us of the one and the other. Every unmortified sin will certainly do two things. Number one, it will weaken the soul and deprive it of its vigor. And number two, it will darken the soul and deprive it of its comfort and peace. Number one, it weakens the soul and deprives it of its strength. When David had for a while harbored an unmortified lust in his heart, and again, lust can generally be any corrupt desire in his heart, and although his was of a more of a sexual nature in that instance with Bathsheba. Again, David had for a while harbored an unmortified lust in his heart. It broke all his bones and left him no spiritual strength. Hence, he complained that he was sick, weak, wounded, and faint. There is, he says, no soundness in me, Psalm 38, verse 3. I am feeble and sore broken, verse 8. Yea, I cannot so much as look up, Psalm 40, verse 12. An unmortified lust will drink up the spirit and all the vigor of the soul and weaken it in all duties. For, first, it untunes and unframes the heart itself by entangling its affections. It diverts the heart from the spiritual frame that is required for vigorous communion with God. It lays hold on the affections, rendering its object beloved and desirable, so expelling the love of the Father. 1 John 2:15 and 1 John 3:17, so that the soul cannot say uprightly and truly to God, "Thou art my portion," having something else that it loves. Fear, desire, hope, which are the choice affections of the soul that should be full of God, will be one way or other entangled with it. So again, this is some unmortified lust in the heart. Secondly, it fills the thoughts with contrivances about it. Thoughts are the great purveyors of the soul to bring in provision to satisfy its affections, and if sin remain unmortified in the heart, they must ever and anon be making provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof, again, the desires of the flesh. They must glaze, adorn, and dress the objects of the flesh and bring them home to give satisfaction, and this they are able to do in the service of a defiled imagination beyond all expression. Thirdly, it breaks out and actually hinders duty. The ambitious man must be studying, and the worldling must be working or contriving, and the sensual, and sensual is more generally just driven by your senses, the sensual vain person providing himself for vanity when they should be engaged in the worship of God. Were this my present business, to set forth the breaches, ruin, weakness, desolations that one unmortified lust will bring upon a soul, this discourse must be extended much beyond my intendment. So that was subpoint one, it weakens the soul. Subpoint two, as sin weakens, so it darkens the soul. It is a cloud, a thick cloud, that spreads itself over the face of the soul and intercepts all the beams of God's love and favor. It takes away all sense of the privilege of our adoption, and if the soul begins to gather up thoughts of consolation, sin quickly scatters them, of which afterward, he plans to speak of afterward. Now, in this regard, does the vigor and power of our spiritual life depend on our mortification? It is the only means of the removal of that which will allow us neither the one nor the other. Men that are sick and wounded under the power of lust, again, any corrupt desire of their heart, men wounded like that make many applications for help. They cry to God when the perplexity of their thoughts overwhelms them. Even to God do they cry, but are not delivered. In vain generally means uselessness. In vain do they use many remedies. They shall not be healed. So Hosea 5:13, Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah his wound and attempted sundry remedies, many remedies. Nothing will do until they come, verse 15, to acknowledge their offense. Men may see their sickness and their wounds, but yet, if they make not due applications, D-U-E, applications, their cure will not be effected. That was sub-point one. This alone keeps sin from depriving us of the one and the other. Again, vigor and comfort in our lives. Number two, mortification prunes all the graces of God and makes room for them in our hearts to grow. The life and vigor of our spiritual lives consists in the vigor and flourishing of the plants of grace in our hearts. So grace like a plant growing in our hearts. Now, as you may see in a garden, let there be a precious herb planted, and let the ground be untilled, and weeds grow about it. Perhaps it will live still, but be a poor, withering, unuseful thing. You must look and search for it, and sometimes can scarce find it. And when you do, you can scarce know it, whether it be the plant you look for or not. And suppose it is, you can make no use of it at all. When let another of the same kind be set in the ground, naturally as barren and bad as the other, but let it be well weeded, and everything that is noxious and hurtful removed from it, it flourishes and thrives. You may see it at first look into the garden, and have it for your use when you please. So it is with the graces of the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, that are planted in our hearts. That is true, they are still, they abide in the heart where there is some neglect of mortification, but they are ready to die, Revelation 3 verse 2. They are withering and decaying. The heart is like the sluggard's field, so overgrown with weeds that you can scarce see the good corn. Such a man may search for faith, love, and zeal, and scarce be able to find any. And if he does discover that these graces are there, yet alive and sincere, yet they are so weak and so clogged with lusts that they are of very little use. They remain, indeed, but are ready to die. But now let the heart be cleansed by mortification, the weeds of lust constantly and daily rooted up, as they spring daily, nature being their proper soil. Let room be made for grace to thrive and flourish. How will every grace act its part and be ready for every use and purpose? That was sub-point two, mortification prunes all the graces of God. And sub-point three, as to our peace, as there is nothing that has any evidence of sincerity without it, so I know nothing that has such an evidence of sincerity in it, which is no small foundation of our peace. Mortification is the soul's vigorous opposition to self, wherein sincerity is most evident. All right, that brings us actually to the end of chapter 4. And we will go ahead and stop there for this reading, and then, Lord willing, pick up with chapter 5 the next time. But until then, go indeed seeking daily for help from God to mortify these sins in our hearts, and that he grant us this peace and vigor of spiritual life, that he help us, and by his Spirit, weed the garden of our hearts, so that graces that he's put there can grow and flourish, and that we can be useful for the glory of his name. And Lord willing, we will talk to you again soon.